A quick note before we start the show, this is your last chance to make a gift to PRI's The World and have it matched thanks to Newsmatch. Your support makes our work possible. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift today. Thanks for your support. Market gyrations and the uncertainty from Washington is not helping. Today on The World. By lots of measures, the U.S. economy looks strong, but global markets are up and then they're down, and the signals from the Trump administration have economists pretty worried.
The reason that this is distressing is that, you know, you can have bad policy, but you can also have weird policy. This was weird policy, and weird policy is highly unsettling because it means that they may not know what they're doing.
But some U.S. businesses look at moves by the Trump administration, and they like what they see.
They believe that Washington is on their side now, and they invest more, they hire more, they take more risks than they might have otherwise.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you with us today. President Trump was on the road for Christmas, on the road and in the air. Trump made a surprise visit to U.S. troops in Iraq, the White House said today. A break, you could say, for a president who lately has been shadowed by tales of chaos in the White House, criticizing the Fed and economists, even his own Treasury Secretary. But global economic news is actually pretty good. Poverty is down. So is unemployment, in this country anyway. Today, the Dow got a big bounce, up more than 1,000 points, but it's still down for the year. Brendan Greeley is U.S. editor of the Alphaville column in the Financial Times.
There are two explanations for what's going on right now. One of them is it seems less likely that companies' earnings will be as high in the future as they were in the past. What that means is costs are going up for companies, and that's good for a lot of Americans. It means that wages are going up. Prices are going up for materials as well at companies. But overall, that doesn't completely explain the slide in stocks over the last month. The other thing that traders in particular hate and that professional investors hate is uncertainty. And so we can look at a lot of technical explanations for this stuff, but there's a more obvious one, which is it's really hard to figure out what is going on. The Trump administration is a very uncertain beast. It has different opinions from day to day. You're not quite sure who speaks for the Trump administration. And so particularly on issues like trade and more recently on Fed policy, it's very hard to figure out what is happening. And that makes institutional investors in particular very, very nervous and much more likely to invest in very safe things like treasuries.
All right. So I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, uncertainty seems to be the common denominator between the stock market and how the Trump administration is working. Is there a connection?
Yeah. I mean, we can look at one day in particular, which was Christmas Eve. So on the 24th, there was no new economic news. There was no new data releases. There were no new events. There was no trade news. Only one thing happened, which was Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, released a memo saying that he had called the heads of the six largest banks in America, had been reassured that there was enough capital at those banks to meet their obligations, and that everything was fine, and that he was going to convene on the next day the president's working group on financial markets. This was a nonsense memo. So there are two parts of it, both of them equally nonsensical. The first one is, of all the things that we should be worried about right now in the world, that the six largest banks in America are adequately capitalized is very low on the list. You know, I was trying to explain what was going on to my wife, and she was listening to me sort of talk about capital ratios and things. And she said, basically, what you're telling me is that we're in a flight, and the captain just came on the intercom and said, everybody, don't worry, there's enough fuel. Well, I mean, yeah, there's enough fuel, but why are we talking about fuel all of a sudden? The second nonsensical part of this memo was that the president's working group on financial markets is an organization that doesn't exist. It's like it's a way that the president can say, hey, guys, America, I am doing a thing. You know, so Mnuchin or Trump or whoever's making this decision is sort of activating things as if there's a financial crisis when there is not a financial crisis at all. And so the reason that this is distressing is that, you know, you can have bad policy, but you can also have weird policy. This was weird policy. And weird policy is highly unsettling because it means that they may not know what they're doing.
That was a weird memo, the one from Mnuchin. You make
right?
a great analogy in your column in the Financial Times this week with football.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, so imagine you're a soccer player, you're on the wing, right? And you go all the way up the field, you get into the far corner, you get trapped, you make a hopeless cross into traffic, it gets blocked, the play is over. So that's a bad decision. You can see why somebody would make that bad decision. But if you were to sort of take the ball down in the corner, get trapped, and then pick the ball up with your hands and shower it with glitter, that's a weird decision. That's not how soccer works. So what we saw on Sunday night was a weird decision. It was glitter on a soccer ball. And so that's really disconcerting to people who work in financial markets, because they want to know, you know, there's very little that the president can do. No matter what any president says, there's very little that any president can do to make things better. There are some things that the president can do to make them much, much worse. And that's introduced the level of uncertainty that we see now in policymaking.
Brendan Greeley, U.S. editor of the Alphaville column in the Financial Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Even with all that uncertainty, President Trump is quick to tout the economy. One thing he's made a point of highlighting is the return of foreign jobs to America.
We have literally hundreds of companies moving back into the United States.
Hundreds of companies? We asked the world's Jason Margolis to dig into that.
Let's cut to the chase. Is President Trump telling the truth? Are hundreds of companies shifting production back to the United States?
So I'd say 300, 400 at least announced in 2017.
That's Harry Moser, president of the Reshoring Initiative, a group that tracks jobs coming back to the United States. Okay, score one for the president. But is a few hundred companies significant? Scott Paul is president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
I would call this movement right now a trickle.
There's considerable debate over how to measure this trend, and there's very little data available. What is clear, however, says Scott Paul, we're seeing more companies that rely on cheap energy, now in abundance in the U.S., coming back.
So that includes some types of chemical processing, some types of plastics. I've also seen, jobs come back in everything from auto parts to textiles and jeans.
Paul says this trend began about a decade ago, and Harry Moser says President Obama got the ball rolling.
He used to call it insourcing. He started a program of increasing our skilled workforce, of apprenticeship programs and certificates. He did many useful things.
And Moser says things have picked up under Trump, with work largely shifting away from Asia. So what's driving this? Each one of those bumps is a 300-ton press stamping out the bowl of a spoon at a factory in Sherrill, New York. The company Oneida began making knives, forks, and spoons here back in 1880. It grew into the largest flatware maker in the world. But by the early 21st century, former employee Greg Owens says the factory closed down and production was shifted mostly to China.
And really, that decision came down to a very daunting statistic, and that was that they could buy product finished, packaged, and put in a box, shipped all the way from China to Long Beach, California, cheaper than they could buy the raw material to make it with here in Sherrill.
Owens, though, didn't accept this. So he and a partner bought the Sherrill factory.
Here was a factory that was a little over 1 million square feet with millions of dollars of equipment. It was the most automated flatware factory in the world by far, and nobody wanted it. So we were basically offered it to purchase it for scrap value.
13 years later, 53 people are working at the Sherrill factory. It's a far cry from the 2,000 people who made forks and knives here just 20 years ago, but it's something. So why did Owens think making cutlery in New York was again possible?
There was actually a study done, I believe it was Consumer Reports, where they did a survey, and 10% of the people are pretty adamant about Made in America. 80% of the people, if all things are equal, will pay the same or up to 10% more for Made in America. When I heard that, I went, okay.
But how do you compete with wages in Asia that are a fraction of what people make in upstate New York?
There's a tremendous markup in the retail chain from a factory in, let's say, China to the end user in Macy's. And something that you buy in the store for $100, the Chinese factory is getting $10 for that.
So Owens cut out the middlemen and now sells his flatware directly to customers through the web. Today, Liberty Tabletop is branded as the only manufacturer of flatware made in the United States. But how much of this reshoring story was influenced by Congress or the White House?
It was not because of anything that was political down in Washington.
I put a similar question to Harry Moser with the Reshoring Initiative. What is driving companies back to the U.S.?
Something everybody can agree on, Chinese wages and prices have gone up significantly in the last 10, 15 years. Wages, certainly the duty, the freight, the intellectual property risk, the travel costs. And when they add all these things. Also automation.
Right. And so for the most part, you listed things that are beyond a president's control, beyond Congress's control. So how much credit or blame does a president deserve for jobs reshoring back or not reshoring back?
In the case of President Trump, clearly his tax reductions and regulatory reductions were important. His commitment to U.S. manufacturing gives confidence, especially to the small to medium-sized companies. They believe that Washington is on their side now, and they invest more, they hire more, they take more risks than they might have otherwise.
But Moser also says some of the president's other policies could undo much of that.
I think continued steel and aluminum tariffs could be a problem.
And Moser adds another big impediment to future growth. American manufacturers need more skilled workers to actually do the work. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
If only skilled workers was the thing Venezuela is worried about, people there have more urgent issues like what they're going to eat tonight for dinner. Venezuela's economy is in free fall. Hyperinflation and massive unemployment have forced tens of thousands of Venezuelans, maybe more, to flee their country. The ones who can't leave are in dire straits. My BBC colleague Vladimir Hernandez is from Venezuela and over the past year has made several trips home. Remember what I said earlier about global economic news actually being pretty good? That's not at all what Vladimir has been seeing this year when he goes home.
Every time I start planning a new trip to Venezuela, I feel like I'm taking this huge intake of air in my lungs in preparation to see suffering on an unimaginable scale. Sadly, things are much worse than I expected every time. Venezuela is a hungry place. In this last year, I've been back several times to the country where I grew up and seen babies incredibly malnourished. I've seen their mothers with almost no tears left after who knows how many nights crying in despair for being unable to feed their children. I've seen tough and hardened children living off scraps in the streets. I've seen crowds of people chasing the bin lorry, trying to get something to eat. Supermarkets are regularly left with empty shelves as shortages and hyperinflation are pushing them closer and closer to a complete shutdown. Any sight of luxury, when I mean luxury it can be a simple steak, is seen with disdain by the majority of those who are unable to pay for it. I clearly remember the anger in the eyes of a woman I met in western Venezuela when she was trying to remember when was the last time she had eaten chicken. The answer was more than 2 years.
Rotten beef is also sold here in this market. It smells strong. It's got flies all over it.
I remember also the time I went to a meat market with inverted commas. Rather than a meat market, it was a place to buy fat and bones. And some were even selling rotten meat at a cut-down price, which incredibly also had customers. Food is only one side of the meltdown of Venezuela. Many cities are struggling with regular power cuts. The economy has shrunk at least in half, leaving many businesses shut down, and not many airlines fly there anymore. And Venezuela has an even darker side. The country has some of the highest murder rates in the world, something I was reminded of earlier this year when I was told that a half-brother had gone out fishing, desperate to get something to eat for his family. But alas, lake pirates appeared out of nowhere and shot him and his companion dead and threw them into the water. Covering Venezuela as a journalist is extremely difficult, but this can become harder beyond imagination when your own family ends up becoming real-life examples of how bad things are. Which is why it is only when I leave Venezuela that I feel I finally breathe out, with some feeling of guilty relief, as what stays behind feels shocking beyond imagination for a country not stricken by war, but by a simple economic collapse.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The American government has been trying to send a message. Migrants without papers, stay home. A lot of countries in Europe are also conveying that message. There is one exception, Spain. Ever since a left-leaning government took power this year, Spain has been laying out the welcome mat for migrants. The country's foreign minister has said Europe needs new blood to compensate for a low birth rate. Now with Italy closing its doors, Spain has become the main route for migrants to get to Europe. But what happens to migrants who choose to settle down in Spain? Catarina Fernandez-Martins has a story of two men in the town of Jerez de la Frontera in southern Spain, one a migrant from sub-Saharan Africa. The other is a local who's trying to help him.
Issa Abdu was just 10 years old when he said goodbye to his parents in Cameroon and began a long journey north. He dreamed of becoming a soccer star in Spain.
I bought a geography book and studied the map to check the borders with Europe. I saw Morocco and Spain and realized it was very near and I could do it.
It took him nearly 10 years, but he finally made it to Spain in 2007.
Juega Iván Camacho, Basir, Karim.
He goes by the name Karim now. Karim isn't a soccer star, but he does play on a professional club team in Jerez. It's called Alma de Africa, Soul of Africa. Alma de Africa includes 25 players of 15 different nationalities, as well as locals.
Que llueve, que nieva, que caen rayos, que caen vacas. Del cielo se entrena. ¿Está claro?
Alejandro Benítez is the club president. 4 years ago, he helped turn a group of immigrant friends playing pickup games into a team.
En un principio hicimos el equipo y no decidimos que fuera de inmigrantes africanos, que eran los que estaban en ese grupo de chicos que jugaban.
We built the team around those African immigrants. Some migrant associations here told us to include some Spaniards to promote the integration from within.
Benítez is a real estate and insurance agent, but Alma de Africa has become the center of his life.
Yo he tenido que hipotecar mucho tiempo de mi trabajo, de mi familia para.
I invest a lot of family and work time in these players. I do it because I believe I have a responsibility towards them. My reward is their gratitude and their happiness for the fact they have the chance to feel equal to everyone else here. They call Alma de Africa their family in Spain.
Karim calls Benítez Prezi, short for president. When Karim needs help, he calls on Benítez. Spain is probably the most welcoming European country for immigrants now. But here in Andalusia, there's growing frustration that their region has become the new frontier for those trying to reach Europe. And there's no clear plan on how to accommodate them. Michelle Bustillo is a social worker who helps migrants.
It's not enough to give migrants some clothing and food. We need a real integration policy.
Faced with the highest unemployment rates in the country and a surge in arrivals, some in Jerez are turning against migrants.
Now people are repeating xenophobic rumors. They're saying migrants are stealing their jobs and spreading diseases.
That might help explain why an anti-immigrant party won 12 seats in the Andalusian parliament this month, the first time a far-right party made it into the government since Spain became a democracy. Benítez is worried about this, but he's not happy with Spain's integration model either. He says it treats migrants like children.
Se le intenta dar facilidades a ellos, intentar que puedan.
The system gives them everything, like housing and job training, without demanding commitment from their side. They grow accustomed to getting everything for free.
That means newcomers don't get the tools they need to lead independent lives here, he says. And it feeds into the unrealistic expectations some migrants have when they arrive. The players of Alma de Africa are no exception. And that's not always easy for Benítez to admit.
Algunos mal pensados piensan que se está lucrando esta asociación.
Some are suspicious we are using them to make money. Others believe they should be paid like Messi or Cristiano because they believe all players are paid in Europe. This creates tension. It's disappointing sometimes.
The club doesn't have enough money to pay the players. So Benitez veers between feeling responsible for them and resenting them for demanding too much. Most of the team's immigrant players scrape by with seasonal jobs as beach vendors or construction workers. Karim says he appreciates what Benitez does for him, but he feels resentful too. When he's not playing with Alma de Africa, Karim watches soccer on TV. He has never had a steady job in the 12 years he has lived in Spain, and he is not working now. Karim says he left Cameroon filled with high hopes. Not long after he got here, he says he realized he had made a mistake. He didn't become a star like Ronaldo or Messi, and he hasn't seen his family in 18 years.
Sí sabía que la vida realidad que yo no venía. Yo no salía de mi casa. Yo me quedaba ahí con mi familia.
If I knew then what I know now, I would have stayed with my family. Life here is tough. It's not what we think it is. We waste a lot of time here.
Karim is ambivalent about Spain, but he says he can't go back. For better or for worse, Spain is home now, and Alma de Africa is his family. For the world, Catarina Fernandes Martins, Jerez de la Frontera.
We've got an update for you on rescue and recovery efforts underway in Indonesia. The tsunami that hit over the weekend killed 430 people. More than 150 people are still missing. Remember, it was a volcano crater that collapsed into the Sunda Strait that caused the tsunami. The earth around that volcano is still unstable, which means another tsunami could be coming soon. So 21,000 people have moved to higher ground. Among them, these Indonesians sheltering in a temporary camp near the Sunda Strait.
I am here because people said there's a possible new tsunami, so that's why I'm evacuating. People who were near the beach were running and suggested people evacuate because of fears, and that's why I rushed here.
I am worried about my house and my kids. I feel uneasy, thinking about my children and my grandchildren.
Rescue workers have been going through coastal communities with sniffer dogs, looking for survivors. It is seriously challenging work. Rosemary North is with the Red Cross.
Yesterday, our search and rescue people from the Indonesian Red Cross were asked to pause because there was a risk of a new tidal surge. And today, there's been very heavy rain and flooding in parts of the coastline. We hope that now the high tides will reduce and people will feel safe enough to go back to the coasts. Of course, you never know when a tsunami is going to hit. If it's triggered close enough to the shore, there won't be enough time for a decent warning.
The rain she mentioned there has been torrential, turning roads into impassable mud alleys. Rescue teams in Western Java are still working even to reach some remote areas. A state of emergency has been declared until Friday next week. At the very least, that will ensure disaster assistance keeps coming. I'm Marco Werman. Hey there, listeners. This is your last chance to make a gift to PRI's The World and have your donation matched dollar for dollar thanks to Newsmatch. Contributions from listeners like you make our work possible, from the international reporting assignments and correspondence on the ground to the studio equipment that makes this show happen every day. You value the world, so I hope you'll make a gift today at theworld.org/match. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks very much for your support. Coming up on The World, Japan says that whaling is part of its culture and is pulling out from the global commission that regulates whale hunting. This conservationist says that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think it's a positive development, and it means that Japan is openly saying that they're commercially whaling when they've been doing that all along.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. They had kept it quiet, but this afternoon the White House announced that Donald and Melania Trump visited U.S. troops in Iraq for Christmas. Trump spent about 3 hours on the ground, and he took the moment to repeat that the United States cannot continue to be the policeman of the world. The president also defended his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. This is what we want to focus on because yesterday, Israeli jets struck targets in Syria just west of Damascus. There have been conflicting reports about the exact targets, but this is not the first time that Israel has launched airstrikes in Syria. Anshul Pfeffer is a correspondent with Haaretz based in Jerusalem. I asked him to explain what happened last night.
The information right now is pretty patchy because none of our sources are complete or extremely trustworthy. Israel hasn't yet put out any official information about what happened, besides to say that a missile defense system was activated. From Syria, we're getting different reports from on the ground of various targets being hit overnight and of anti-aircraft missiles being fired in response. And we have a statement from the Russian Defense Ministry regarding an attack carried out by Israeli aircraft, which is also seems to be tailored towards trying to say how efficient Russia's ally, the Assad regime, has been in repulsing the attack. So none of these reports are to be entirely trusted. What it does seem to have been is an Israeli attack on Iranian assets in Syria, probably some kind of weapon system which was being supplied to Hezbollah, which is Iran's militia or proxy there in the region. That's more or less what we've been seeing for the last 5 or 6 years happening quite regularly here.
Right. Well, I see, as you say, the information is kind of patchy and a little confusing. Yeah. Why is Israel pinpointing the Syrian targets?
Since the Syrian war began, Israel hasn't taken sides in any serious manner. But it has also made clear that they won't allow this period of chaos to be used by Hezbollah and by Iran to boost the capabilities that they have across Israel's borders. So from what we know, most of these attacks are aimed at arms shipments and convoys orchestrated by the Iranians to help Hezbollah build up its capabilities north of Israel.
So how have various players in the region been reacting to this news? What are they saying?
We haven't heard that much besides some statements from the Assad regime, but this hasn't really been a main factor in the Syrian war. I mean, what's been happening, the pullback of American special forces from northeast Syria, Turkey's advance towards that area and its battles against the Kurds, and so on. Those are much more pivotal events. So the regional players haven't really been responding that much to the Israeli issue. That's almost a sideshow to the bigger story of the Syrian war.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because this is all happening just days after President Trump announced that the U.S. will withdraw its 2,000-some-odd troops from Syria. What does Trump's decision mean for Israel and other players involved in Syria?
I think Israel, like other players who are involved in Syria, have been aware that the United States quite consciously decided already under Obama not to have a major role. So what Donald Trump decided is basically sealing a process which has been happening for years now. And Israel, like the other players in the region, are adapting themselves to a much more reduced American footprint here in the region. And within that vacuum left by the United States, we have Russia, who's become the most influential power here.
So some people would say that a Syria with Bashar al-Assad still in power is, in a sense, the devil Israel already knows. Israel may not like that Assad is still there, but at least Israel knows what to expect with this reality. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's very true. And amongst Israeli military analysts, there's been different views about how to view the future of Syria. And there were those who said, Assad is an enemy, Assad is an ally of Iran, it would be good to see the back of him. And there have been those who said, Assad is the devil we know, and whatever will come after him could well be ISIS and various other kind of al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations. For all his faults, Assad the father and Assad the son kept the peace on Israel's northern border since 1973. So even when the Syrians were involved in various things against Israel from Lebanon, the Syrian border itself remained peaceful. So I think that for Israeli military planners, the fact that Assad is back in control of the area may not make them very happy because he's not a friend of Israel, but at least it sort of reduces tension. That's Israel's main concern right now.
Anshul, one last thing. As you look into the new year and just overall, would you say there's a new sense of concern for Israel's security among military intelligence types? And does the U.S. exit from Syria have symbolic meaning for Israel?
The U.S. exit from Syria has not just symbolic meaning, it has strategic meaning. The fact that Israel has decent working relationships with the Kremlin, with the various levels among the Russian leadership. That's important, but that's nowhere near anything that Israel's ever enjoyed with the United States. And Israel doesn't want the United States to leave this region because the United States has a stabilizing effect on the region. So that's a concern, certainly a concern with the fact that the Iranians are entrenching their presence in Syria. So all these things are reason for concern. But that concern has been, it's not new. It's not new to 2018 and 2019. It's something which has been going on for years. And that's why we're seeing these periodic airstrikes, where Israel's trying to interdict various Iranian actions.
Angel Pfeffer, correspondent with Haaretz, speaking with us from Jerusalem. Thank you very much for your thoughts today.
You're very welcome.
Did you ever see Star Trek IV when Kirk and the rest of the crew swoop down to protect a pair of humpback whales being hunted on Earth?
All right, Scotty, it's up to you.
10 seconds, Admiral.
Yeah, the whales got beamed up. Don't remember? Well, it's an old movie from the 80s. I can't believe I said old. Anyway, the film reminded us that whale hunting still goes on in some parts of the world. Japan, for instance. They argue it's part of their culture. Today, in fact, Japan announced it plans to withdraw from the International Whaling Commission. They're the ones that regulate global whaling. So I was a little surprised today when I spoke with Paul Watson, founder of the marine conservation group Sea Shepherd, and he said this about Japan's announcement.
I think it's a positive development, and it means that Japan is openly saying that they're going, that they're commercially whaling when they've been doing that all along under the guise of research whaling. But by openly saying this, they can no longer kill whales in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary, so that's a victory for us.
I mean, that is a somewhat surprising answer coming from you. Are you essentially saying that by backing out of the International Whaling Commission, Japan is basically going to be more transparent about what it's doing?
Well, Japan has now declared that they're going to be commercially whaling, which is what they've been doing, but denying all along. So, yes, that makes it a lot easier for us to oppose them, because even though the International Court of Justice ruled against Japan's fraudulent research whaling, they continue to do it anyway.
Remind us what nations still hunt whales, and what will Japan's decision to withdraw from the International Whaling Commission mean to those countries? Will it push them to abandon treaties as well?
Iceland and Norway have been blatantly killing whales for commercial purposes, despite the IWC. So Japan will just simply be joining their ranks without this bogus justification of research whaling. So it puts them in the same category. But what it will mean for the International Whaling Commission is that it will no longer be stymied by the boats that the Japanese continue to buy every year to block every conservation effort. So at the meeting of the IWC in Brazil just recently this year, the IWC said, no, we're not going to entertain the idea of commercial whaling anymore. And that's why Japan is looking at getting out of the IWC and just going ahead and doing what Iceland and Norway are doing.
What does this decision actually mean for the number of whales killed into the future? And what's it going to mean for conservation efforts? It sounds like it could be kind of unpredictable.
Well, it's going to be great for the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary and the South Atlantic Whale Sanctuary and the entire Southern Hemisphere. No whales will be killed in the Southern Hemisphere. They will intend to kill whales in their own waters, like Norway and Iceland do right now. And, of course, we will oppose that. But this development is really good from the point of view of whale conservation.
What does Japan do with whale flesh these days? I mean, is it eaten? Is it used for energy, like oil?
Well, we got thousands of tons of it stockpiled in their refrigerated warehouses, which isn't used. It's a highly subsidized industry. It carries on primarily for political reasons. The fact that the Prime Minister Abe is from a whaling district, and that the union that supplies the crew are a Yakuza union, which puts a lot of pressure on the government, and the fact that
Yakuza is kind of a Japanese underground. Some people have called it a mafia.
It is a Japanese mafia, yes. And they control the union, which supplies the sailors. And the other thing is that the board members of the whaling company, which is a government-owned company, are retired politicians who get significant salaries for the continuation of whaling. It doesn't benefit the Japanese people. Less than 1% of the Japanese people eat whale meat, so it's hardly an ongoing venture.
I mean, I was in Japan shortly after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011. One town, Ishinomaki, really depended upon the whaling industry. I mean, economically, what does it mean for Japan?
Well, it's absolutely insignificant economically. And if it disappears from tomorrow, it'll be great. I mean, what people don't understand is that whales are a very important part of our global ecological aquatic system. They provide the nutrients, the phytoplankton. The phytoplankton provides the oxygen that we breathe. When you diminish whale populations, you diminish phytoplankton populations. And since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton populations. The whales belong to all of us, not to the Japanese or the Norwegians or the Icelanders. They should be left alone to do what they do best, which is to as caretakers of the sea.
Captain Watson, I'm curious to know how close your organization, Sea Shepherd, has gotten to any outright conflict with some of those Japanese surveillance ships.
Well, we've been in confrontations with them for years. Pretty aggressive clashes, and that's how we were able to stop them from killing whales on many occasions. In fact, in one year, they only took 10% of their quota, but most years, only 30% of their quota, because our method is to get behind them to prevent them to load whales onto the factory ship, and it's a highly effective method. And, of course, that resulted in numerous court cases against us and some high seas confrontations and water cannon fights and stink bombs and on and on and on. But what's happened is that in order to stop our opposition in 2017, they put in about $50 million worth of security efforts using real-time military surveillance to keep us from approaching them. And that's an expensive thing. They just can't keep it up.
Captain Paul Watson, the founder of Sea Shepherd, the whale conservation organization, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This year was a big one for climate change news. It feels like we've talked about it practically every day for the past few months here. It turns out the next 2 years will be even more important, at least when it comes to policymakers dealing with climate change. The World's Carolyn Beeler takes a look back and gives us a sneak peek ahead as we round out the year.
Natalie Mahowald has been researching climate change for 20 years. But to her, this year, 2018, felt a little different.
To me, it feels like there's more attention on the issue.
Mahowald is an atmospheric sciences professor at Cornell.
I covered in my classes, and there were so many articles this year that we couldn't even post all the articles onto our discussion board. It was just too much.
Mahowald thinks part of the focus on climate change came from the weather.
We saw a lot of intense storms. And of course, we can't attribute any one storm to climate change. But these intense hurricanes are what we fear will occur more frequently under climate change.
Besides those storms, an onslaught of new science released this fall also landed climate change in the headlines. Here's University of Arizona professor Diana Liverman.
There were a whole series of reports and papers that really raised the bar in terms of the potential impacts of climate change and the urgency of doing something about it.
Liverman and Mahowald both helped write one of those big papers from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It found that limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would significantly cut a bunch of climate risks. Risks like drought, heavy rainfall during hurricanes, extreme heat, sea level rise. The report gave policymakers a lower target to aim at than the 2 degrees Celsius written into the Paris Agreement. But how hard it would be to hit that target surprised even Liverman.
I've been working on climate change for a very long time, at least 30 years. And I think what surprised me was realizing how dramatic the cuts are that we need to make to keep warming under 1.5. I mean, cutting emissions by half by 2030, that's an enormous challenge.
Especially since carbon pollution is on the rise again. Now, if 2018 showed us how big the challenge really is, 2019 and 2020 will be key to overcoming it, or not.
If we do not change course by 2020, we risk missing the point where we can avoid runaway climate change with disastrous consequences for people and all the natural systems that sustain us.
That was the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. And let me take a minute here to tell you why he's saying 2020 is going to be such a big deal. It's the deadline under the Paris Agreement for countries to set new targets for how much they'll cut carbon by 2030. And 2030, if you remember, is the cutoff date for making those huge cuts to keep that 1.5 degree goal alive. Guterres is holding a special UN summit next September to try to drum up big promises ahead of that deadline.
I'm calling on all leaders to come to next year's climate summit prepared to report what more they intend to do when they convene in 2020 for the UN climate conference.
If countries stick to the promises they've already made, we're headed for about 3 degrees of warming. So the 1.5-degree goal is a huge reach. But Chandra Bhushan with the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi says it's worth a try.
We understand that meeting 1.5-degree goal is going to be very, very difficult. But we still have to try, because if we do not try to meet 1.5, I don't think we will even meet 2 degrees.
Bhushan represents the Global South at UN Climate Talks and says the region will acutely feel if temperatures keep rising.
And that is going to be really, really bad for the poor countries, vulnerable communities who are already suffering because of climate change. So the next 2 years are going to be very, very important.
Key dates to watch for: the Secretary General's meeting in New York in September, and then the UN Climate Summit in 2020. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A celebratory return. That's what greeted reggae and dancehall superstar Buju Banton at the airport in Kingston, Jamaica last month. Back home after 7 years in prison here in the U.S. for drug trafficking. But Buju Banton's arrest is not the only thing in his life to have earned him notoriety.
It's like boom, bye, bye, in a body boy head. Who by now promote no nasty man.
This is Boom, Bye, Bye. You can find a lot of Buju Banton's music streaming online, but not this song. It's about killing gay people.
Send for the matic and the Uzi instead. Shoot them, no come make we shot them.
Boom Bye Bye was one of the first songs Buju Banton recorded about 25 years ago. He has now rejected violence against the LGBT community, but he can't shake off the reputation of that record, which makes Buju Banton's story a complex one for many Jamaicans, including Stacey Ann Chin. She's an LGBT activist and poet who now lives here in the U.S. Stacey Ann told me she was out shopping near her home in New York when she heard the news about Banton going back to Jamaica.
I was in IKEA in Brooklyn, and it was a Jamaican woman who was serving me in IKEA, and she said with such jubilation that she's coming home, and she also said with such vitriol that the reason that he was in prison in the first place was the hatred of the gay community and the kind of like international, almost organized way in which they systematically went after him and took him down.
Which is, of course, not true. He served 7 years in U.S. prison for drug trafficking, cocaine.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. But there are still people on the ground in Jamaica who feel as if the only reason that he was behind those bars was because he was being targeted by the gay community, by the very powerful gay community, as we are often described as by the reggae community.
Before serving time for drug trafficking in the U.S., Buju Banton had disavowed violence, I read, physical or musical, toward the gay community. He served his 7 years, is now out. How much has he changed from the man who sang Boom Bye Bye 25 years ago?
I think that's a very complicated question. I think the lesbian Jamaican activist optimist, the lover of where I'm from, it's a very complicated place to sit, because the issue of being more than one identity at the same time, and maybe those two identities don't coexist comfortably, is always a difficult place for anybody to sit. But I grew up with reggae music, and so there's a part of me that really, really loves it, really answers to it when I hear it. Cut to years later, I came out as a lesbian on the university campus in Jamaica and was violently assaulted by a large number of boys. Their intention must have been to either punish me for being gay or to convert me to being straight. And that violence lives with me my whole life. And so the two things inside of me are consistently at war, and they are always wrestling on a mat, and they are always trying to find a way to live together because they are so much a part of me.
I hear all these complicated feelings coming from you about this. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. The woman in IKEA, again, I mean, how much do you think his fans are aiding and abetting his life and his celebrity? I mean, how much of the blame do they shoulder?
But isn't that the nature of prophetdom and celebrity, which to the in today's world, it's one and the same? Buju is in every way a human being, just like me, just like you. But he's also extraordinarily talented and extraordinarily able to speak from a place of deep truth about poverty in Jamaica, about people's lives. He's able to articulate an experience that has been missing from much of the music we call ours. You know, not since Bob Marley has there been an artist that speaks with such truth, with such depth, with such beauty about the lives of poor people and the struggle to be recognized as human for blackness and being from Africa, to be the center of one's pleasure and one's power.
Remind us, Stacien, what the reception to Boom Bye Bye was when it first came out.
It's interesting that you ask that, because the first time I heard Boom Bye Bye, I threw my hands up and sang along because I was a teenager in Jamaica. So I sang with gusto along with my peers to the song. And then I became aware of the fact that I wanted to partner with women. And it became complicated for me because it was actually saying, kill gay people, kill gay men, shoot them in the head, which is in no way permissible when you are a person who is gay, because you're actually advocating for the death of your own kind, your own person. And after the experience in Jamaica where I was attacked by homophobes in Jamaica, some violent homophobes in Jamaica, and I came to the U.S., I started to articulate a politics around my queer identity. Then I began to see how it was not just problematic, and I began to see how it was that I had a right to respond and that I could join a fight to speak out against this kind of violence.
Do you think homophobes in Jamaica still see Boom Bye Bye as kind of an anthem?
You can just say Boom Bye Bye and people in Jamaica kind of know what you mean. It's clear what it is that you're saying, what you're referencing. But I, you know, cut to 2012 when my daughter was born and I took her home and was spending so much time in Jamaica. I saw gay people everywhere. Things have changed dramatically. I mean, I've performed at a gay pride in Jamaica. The gay activists walk about. There are groups on campus that meet. Things have changed, as they should. And I do believe that the conversation around Boom Bye Bye helped to make that possible.
Are you able to compartmentalize to the point where you've forgiven him for Boom Bye Bye?
I don't think that it is my place to forgive Buju Banton for Boom Bye Bye. I think he walks his own journey. I think if I am honest, I see him as a man who is like me, trying to find his way in the world, trying to find his purpose, trying to do the things that he thinks are right. And if one of the things that he thinks is right is going to hurt somebody else, I'm going to take him to task for it always. But I'm not going to try to obliterate him as a human being. You know, his music has been a trumpet for many, many people whose pain he speaks and sings and articulates in a very important way.
Stacien Chen, thank you so much for this. Really appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Mad love back.
Poet and LGBT activist Stacien Chen on the return of artist Buju Banton, now back home in Jamaica. Stacien told me that she still loves his album, Till Shiloh. Here's a taste of Till I'm Laid to Rest. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
Ethiopia awaits all prince and princess till I'm laid to rest. Yes, always be depressed. There's no life in the West. I know the East is the best. Yes, propaganda.
PRI, Public Radio International.